From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Declan McManus took his rock and roll name from the King and from his grandmother. On today's Fresh Air, Elvis Costello joins us to talk about his music and to sing a few new songs. Also today, I talk with actor Michael Tucker. He's best known as Stuart Markowitz on L.A. Law. He co-stars with Brian Dennehy in a new made-for-TV movie about America's race to build the atomic bomb. Rock historian Ed Ward looks back at the music that came out of rural Louisiana in the early 60s. And book critic John Leonard reviews Margaret Atwood's new novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Let me introduce my guest, Elvis Costello, by quoting rock critic Greil Marcus. Quote, "In 1977, Elvis Costello emerged in London as one of the unquestioned originals of modern pop music. Just 22 when he released his first album, My Aim Is True, he seemed master of every rock and roll move, on record and off. He combined the brains of Randy Newman and the implausibility of Bob Dylan, the everyman pathos of Buddy Holly, and the uniqueness of John Lennon. Everything was up for grabs in his music. Love, money, status, hope, fear, and perhaps most of all, the very notion of control. No punk in terms of craft, he rode the punk wave because he communicated a more authentic bitterness than any punk. His demands on the world were more powerful, and thus his rejection of the world, when it failed to deliver, was more convincing." Unquote. Elvis Costello is the performing name of singer, songwriter, and guitarist Declan McManus. He's here today with his guitar, but before he plays for us, let's hear something from his new album. It's his 12th studio album, his first on Warner Brothers Records. Costello's songs on this new record show off his wide range of stylistic influences, rock and roll, pop, jazz, and political ballads. One song was co-written by Paul McCartney, who has a cameo on the record, as do Roger McGuinn and Alan Toussaint. On this song, Deep Dark Truthful Mirror, Costello is backed by the New Orleans musicians, the Dirty Dozen Brass Band.
One day you're gonna have to face a deep, dark, truthful mirror. And it's gonna tell you things that I still love you too much to say. The sky was just a purple bruise. The ground was iron, and you fell all around the town until you looked the same. Same eyes, same lips, same light from your tongue drips. Deep dark, truthful mirror.
Elvis Costello, welcome to Fresh Air. It was mentioned in an article that when you first started to perform, you were performing folk music. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Well, when I first picked up the guitar when I was about 14 or 15, you know.
What kinds of songs?
From the start, I wrote my own songs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I learned a few chords. I learned, like, a couple of songs just off the radio. And then once I realized the trick of it, I just went back through all my favorite songs. I learned Beatles songs. I learned, like, folk songs. Not so much traditional songs. I never much cared for them, actually. But then I went and played in folk clubs, and I actually, for ages, for about 3 years, I never played anybody else's songs. I always played my own. I mean, I dread to think what they might be like now. You know, that girl in the class, she won't speak to me. You know. So like,
Well, you when you started to perform, your manager gave you the name of Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
Elvis from Elvis Presley, Costello from your mother's maiden name.
No, it's my great grandmother actually.
Oh, yeah. I see. Okay.
You see all these things, they get like changed slightly, and then it gets passed on. You know.
Well, I remember being in England in 1977 and looking at one.
Don't
of the,
we all?
Looking at one of the magazines and seeing that great picture of you, like the one that was on the album cover of My Aim Is True, with you in the name Elvis Costello in a kind of Buddy Holly-ish pose, and it was such a striking photo. I knew I had to go hear you, and I think that's. A lot of people felt that way, even just by the photograph, that there was something happening here that was kind of interesting. Who was responsible for that pose, and how did you feel about it?
It was just a coincidence, you know. Mm-hmm. This is the happy thing about it. If it had been amazingly contrived, I think it would have been hard to sustain. And obviously, beyond a certain point, I don't want to be pegged as the same person as I was at 22. The way anybody wouldn't want to, you know, be constantly reminded of something. But when I first started, I remember as doing that photo session. I had two jackets at this point. That's all I had, two jackets. You know, I was trying them on, and we did some shots with the, with this tweed jacket, and that even considering I was wearing horn rims, that seemed a little bit too serious. So I put on this other jacket, kind of a mohair jacket. And I said, we're happening now. And I had my electric guitar, which we didn't have plugged in, so that immediately makes it kind of comical. And I think all I remember is the photographer, Keith Morris, and my manager, both of them guzzling bottles of cider, which was our chosen drink because it was very cheap, sort of all going, go on, throw the funny legs, you know, do some of those rock and roll. But kind of as a send-up of that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So contrary to the image of the intense, sort of furious young man that's often written about in such romantic terms by rock critics. We were having a joke at the expense of all that imagery, and people fail to see the gag, you know, obviously, because it you're frozen there for a moment, and it came to represent something else, because the music obviously wasn't humorous like that. It was aggressive, you know, so there's a curious little inside story. You know?
Was there anything liberating for you about having a persona? So that did it help at all in pouring out your emotions? Because there was something actorly about it as well.
No, because I mean I'd learned through a harsh apprenticeship, which I'm sure everybody. I'm not saying it was any harder for me, you know. I toughened up my voice. I knew how to sing very loud, because I'd had to shut people up in clubs when I was playing solo. I'd played in bands, and all the sort of things, the way you learn. Now, I mean, a lot of people these days might get plucked out of obscurity at 19 and turned into some sort of sensation for 15 minutes and then thrown back outside again. So I count myself as rather lucky that didn't happen, because obviously I had still a lot to learn. And even once I started making records, I still had to learn how to make records, because even that first record has a naivety about it, which obviously is very attractive to some people, but it grates on me because I can hear all of the awkwardness of being in the studio and not really knowing how to sing and everything on mic. I knew how to sing at a club and everything, but I had to relearn all of that, all this technique and everything, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it's not to put it down, but it's different for me to listen to it than for other people, you know.
Right from the start, there was something really different about the songs that you were writing and the lyrics you were writing. And I think back to one of your early songs, like Mystery Dance. There's a long history in rhythm and blues and rock and roll of people writing songs bragging about their sexual prowess, and then you come up with a song about someone who doesn't know how to do it.
Well, you know, I think there should be.
I still,
I'm still doing this, fulfilling this role as I see it. You know, you can't do it too consciously, because it's like being contrary, you know. But I do think there should be songs to sing for the people, you know, that don't have a voice. You know, there's plenty of songs that represent the other people. So once in a while, it's so easy to fall into the pattern. I thought, it isn't like saying, well, that's really me all the time. In the same way now, you know, you might sing a song that might express one point of view, which you're moved to write about that. Now, other people might say, well, you know, what does that mean to do that? You know, say a song from the new record called Let Him Dangle is about this this famous hanging case that went on in 1952. It's a story I've known most of my life. Some people go, well, why do you write that? You know, because it's not going to change anybody's mind. Anybody that really believes in capital punishment really believes in it, and you're not going to sway them with the song. But I feel there should be songs to sing for the people who do think my way about it, that it's wrong. And it shouldn't just be down to arguments. There should be songs, there should be poems, there should be paintings. There should be whatever ways we can express our feelings about it. They all go together. They all mean something in the long run. It's on a scale with these other people who, you know, a lot of the time are arguing for the sake of political gain and not really for what they believe, you know.
My guest was Elvis Costello, and you've brought a guitar with you. Would it be okay for me to ask you to sing a song?
Sure. I'll get out this guitar here. I'll sing this song I wrote in Greenland. Can I sing a song I wrote?
Sure, yeah.
This is a first on public radio. Here we go. Song written in Greenland, 500 miles above the Arctic Circle, in a place called Uminak. I was on holiday up there. And, you know, all they have up there is huskies and big blue icebergs and the few surviving large mammals in the sea. You know? And, you know, when they tell children that Santa Claus lives at the North Pole, you know, I started to think maybe God lived at the North Pole. when you look down the world at what we laughingly call civilization, these thoughts came to mind, and I made up this little story about this comedian who dies and goes to heaven and has to face his maker. Now, of course, he's made a career out of playing a drunk on stage. Do you remember those drunk acts they used to have?
Yep.
Only this guy plays a drunk priest. So, being as he's been making fun of God's mercenaries on Earth, he's more than a little nervous.
I wish you'd known me when I was alive. I was a funny fella. The crowd would hoot and holler for more. I wore a drunk's red nose for applause. Oh yes, I was a comical priest with a joke for the flock and a hand up your fleece. Drool in the drink and the lipstick and grease paint down the cardboard front of my dirty dog collar. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And I'm going on to meet my reward. I was scared, I was scared, I was scared, I was scared. He might have never heard God's comic. So there he was on a waterbed, drinking a cola of a mystery brand, reading an airport novelette, listening to Andrew Lloyd Webber's Requiem. He said before it had really begun, I prefer the one about my son. I've been wading through all of this unbelievable junk and wondering if I should have given the world to the monkeys. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And you're going on to meet your reward. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? He might have never heard that God's comic. I'm gonna take a little trip down paradise's endless shores. Sitting here on the top of the world, I hang around in the darkest night until each beast has gone to bed. And then I say, God bless, and put out the light. While you lie in the dark, afraid to breathe, you're begging, you promise, and you bargain and you plead. Sometimes you confuse me with Santa Claus. It's the big white beard, I suppose. I'm going up to the pole where you folks die of cold. I might be gone for a while if you need me. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And you're all going on to meet your reward. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? You might have never heard, but God's coming.
Great song. That's Elvis Costello performing in our studio. And that song, God's Comic, is on his new album, Spike, which has just come out on Warner Brothers Records. Is your idea of like a just God, a God who knows enough to not like Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Well, you know, God's little waiting room there that he's in gets bigger and bigger in my imagination every day. You know, the detail becomes clearer. The song will probably get longer as I go on. You know, the waterbed's now blue and it's full of tropical fish. And I see God watching 5 televisions at once, you know, because he can do those things. You know, he can see everything. So he watches, like, you know, he watches the colorized version of It's a Wonderful Life, you know, and 9.5 Weeks and CNN all at once. You know, he can do that. And he reads, like, Jackie Collins with one eye, you know, rock star or something like that, and a Jeffrey Archer book with the other eye. And
but does he have good taste?
Well, he reads, with his third eye, he reads Bret Easton Ellis, so you tell me. and his head, you know, I was never really sure when it says that God says I should have given the world to the monkeys, that maybe it should have been spelled, you know, K-E-E-S, you know, and maybe God should get his red guitar out. Take the last train of Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You know, that's God singing there. That wasn't me.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your music, but first we have to take a short break. And Elvis Costello is my guest. He has a new album called Spike. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Elvis Costello is my guest, and your first album came out in 77 or 78. Now,
77.
Like 12 or 13 years later, whatever it is, do you still feel alienated from the mainstream of rock music?
Not really. I think they're alienated from me. They're all wrong. It's not me. No, I never really consider it that much. I like some things. You know, I like some, like I like Bon Jovi. You know, I like that Bad Medicine song. I think that's a good song. And then another time I'll like something, you know, way off that most other people haven't heard, you know, and not that I, you know, people seem to think that songwriters have some special information, you know. I mean, I read the same papers, the same books, see the same films, watch the same television programs, eat the same food as everybody else, and I don't really consider in a big way what's going on in the mainstream. I think that's kind of a journalistic device, you know.
You once said that you thought there was just a lot of dishonesty in most pop lyrics.
Well, there still is. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things made. A lot of small things made very large, you know, and there's a lot of talk about love, you know, but there isn't a lot of it evident, you know. There's a lot of the word love is used a lot in songs, but I don't hear a lot of it in the subject matter, and it's not in the imagery with which the songs are presented.
Do you think there's a kind of lyric that's become bankrupt, that it's difficult to write or sing anymore?
Well, no, because whenever you just get that impression, somebody will come up and write a beautiful love song that uses all the, you know, the 18 words it takes to write a love song and really turn it on its head, you know? I mean, there's a song on the new album that my wife Cot wrote that I think is, if I had written the words, I might have been looking for, like, new words to describe those things. And sometimes you can kind of lead yourself down a blind alley by doing that, because you get afraid to use the simple words that everybody recognizes, because there have been surveys and all the mannerisms and everything. Can I play a little bit of this song?
Oh, sure, yeah. This is Baby Plays Around.
Baby Plays Around. See, I wrote this song, I'll just play a verse of it. This is a song Chet Baker just did before he died, and I wrote it with him in mind, funnily enough, and this is about the fifth time this has happened to me now. I write songs with no way of ever knowing whether the song's going to reach these people, and suddenly they pick it up. It happened with Dusty Springfield, it happened with Johnny Cash, it happened with George Jones, it happened with Roy Orbison, and now it's happened again. So I wrote this song, so this is an example, really, of what I'm saying. This is a little verse from a song called Almost Blue. You know? Yeah. Almost blue, almost doing things we used to do. There's a girl here and she's almost you. Almost all the things that your eyes once promised I see in hers too.
Now your eyes are red from crying, almost blue.
See, so that song is it's fine in its own way, but it's already gets into like a lot of sort of goes a little round the houses a bit. You know, it's pretty enough. But then there's this other song, which I think is kind of a better song. So, also, I might remember all the chords of this one.
It's not open to discussion anymore. She's out again tonight, and I'm alone once more. She's all I have worth waiting for. Baby plays around, and so it seems I've always been the last to know. To hold on to that girl, I had to let her go. I wish to God I didn't love her so. Baby plays around. I try to be strong, hold on to my pride. She doesn't even know it's wrong, how much I hurt inside. Then heaven knows I've tried, but baby plays around. Just a plaything, it's hard to reconcile the facts I'm facing. It's not open to discussion anymore. She walks those shiny streets, I walk the worn out floor. She's all I have worth living for, but baby plays around.
And that song's on your new record.
It's on the new record, yeah. And I mean, I went out to buy a paper, and when I got back, Cod had written that and sung it into the tape recorder. See, but it has simpler language, and it's just the job was just to find out, you know, how to say it very plainly. And I mean, on the record, it's not a lot different to the way I played it then. There's a couple more instruments playing, but very softly. And, you learn a little as you go on from listening to other things. And obviously, you start off with a model or something that might be in your head. In the case of that Almost Blue song, it was, you know, a little bit after a song called The Thrill Is Gone, and a little bit after the song Gloomy Sunday, you know, the same. I wanted to create the same sort of mood. Now, that's a big task. So maybe I hadn't really learnt quite enough, and although I'm proud of the song and I'm delighted that Chet Baker did a version on it, I still think, as a singer and everything, I had to learn a little bit more. And, you know, really, sometimes somebody coming straight into it and just sort of, like, seeing exactly what they want to say without all this stuff, you know, that you have to go through, maybe can write a song like that. And my job is just to put the chords behind the melody, because Cot doesn't play the guitar. She just sings the tune straight out of her head, which is like a magic trick, you know, to me.
Where does your persona exist now? You still record under the name of Elvis Costello, although I think you legally changed your name back to Declan McManus. Is that just a name you use for recording now?
Well, it's a brand name, you know. It's like Ferrari or something, you know. People remember it, and it would be foolish, you know, to dispense with it completely. And from time to time, I use different names as a theatrical device. I mean, if actors won't put down their role, they're thought to be rather neurotic, you know. Whereas in music, it seems like if you change your name, it must it's burnt onto your psyche or something. And amateur psychoanalysis is a favorite pastime of rock critics, and they seem to read far too much. I mean, they transfer their neurosis onto you, which I think is rather unfortunate for them, really. You know, it doesn't really bother me. I leave it all behind, you know. I've done shows. I did the show with a spinning songbook where I put all of the song titles on this big 20-foot game show wheel and had people come out of the audience and spin it in order to select the material for the show that night. And, I mean, I needed an MC personality for that. It wasn't appropriate to do it as me. So I invented this Napoleon Dynamite character who could say outrageous things to the girls that came up to spin the wheel and you know, I'd cajole them into the go-go cage. And we had perfectly ordinary people who came for a night out getting into a cage and go-go dancing. Now, I couldn't persuade them to do that, but Napoleon could, you know. On another occasion, I've released records under the names of the Coward Brothers and The Imposter. It's a theatrical device, you know, and that's just it. It's the name. Nothing dark about it, you know.
Your first records were made in the context of in the climate of punk rock, and whether you felt a part of that or not, that was one of the very radical things happening at the time. How do you think that starting to record at that time affected you as a performer and affected the way your work was perceived?
I've no idea about the perception side of it because that's for other people to say, but it meant that I adopted a musical language quite consciously that was very, very narrow. And it really helped edit out a lot of maybe unnecessary things. It also edited out some things which I appreciated, but I thought there would be another time to present. Like, I wrote a song about 1975 called Stranger in the House, which later I recorded with George Jones. Now, I recorded a version of that at the sessions for my first record, but I didn't think it was right to include it on the album because, you know, country music was like, you know, was like the opposite of punk rock in people's perception. And while I bothered about whether anybody thought I was a punk or not, I didn't want to confuse people by doing too many different things, like as if it was a card trick. You know, here I am, I'm very versatile. I wanted to have a very definite, you know, go at this first record, and hence the name of the album, I Am Is True, and the arrangements are very simple. And, you know, I suppose it might sound a little arrogant, but I had the notion that I might get to make a second record, but I didn't really know. So the best way to ensure that I got a second record was to make sure the first one was very definite, you know.
One last question. A lot of your early records were about anger and frustration, and then your songwriting really opened up to encompass all kinds of different subjects and different emotions. I was wondering if that reflected an emotional change in you, just a broadening of your music, or, you know, if you had lost any of that anger, if that was just one part of your music that we were seeing then.
Well, like I said, I made a conscious decision that I was going to leave certain things out. There are many more feelings than even, you know, 15 albums worth of songs can express. You know, we're human beings. If we have to be pegged to one, you know, when people kind of go, I was in France recently, you know, and they interviewed me, and they had this very kind of limited view from 1977 of who I was and what I was about, and they said, "So how does it feel to be Mr. 8? And I said, "What?" I said, "Is it true that you ate French people?" And I said, "No, I'm sorry to make a joke with you, but I spat them out and did it my way."
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Elvis Costello, and he has a new album called Spike that's just out on Warner Brothers Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Barry Lopez, and he writes about man's relationship with nature. His books include Arctic Dreams, in which he explored the influence of the Arctic landscape on the human imagination, and of wolves and men. I hope you can join us. Here's some music from Elvis Costello's new record, Spike.
Pretty little head of yours, what goes on in that place in the dark? Well, I used to know a girl, and I could have sworn that her name was Veronica. Well, she used to have a carefree mind of her own and a delicate look in her eyes.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Michael Tucker played Woody Allen's father in Radio Days. He plays Stuart Markowitz on L.A. Law, and later this week, he stars as a nuclear physicist in a made-for-TV movie about the Manhattan Project. Coming up, a talk with Michael Tucker. Also, what do songs like Matilda, See You Later, Alligator, and Sweet Dreams have in common? Rock historian Ed Ward says they're all examples of the rich music scene in Louisiana that blossomed in the early 1960s. And book critic John Leonard reviews Margaret Atwood's new novel, Cat's Eye. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The White House is billing a meeting now underway at the White House as a strategy session on the troubled nomination of Defense Secretary-designate John Tower. President Bush, Senate Minority Leader Robert Dole, Virginia Republican John Warner, and Chief of Staff John Sununu are participating in the meeting, which is capping a day when the president vowed to fight for every last vote to win confirmation for his nominee. The president lobbied senators at the White House all day, as NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
President Bush met with 12 senators throughout the day, telling reporters he was committed to Tower's nomination and working hard at it. Asked if he'd picked up any new supporters, Bush merely said, "Stay tuned." The president must hold all the Republicans and pick up at least 5 Democrats for Tower to be confirmed. The vote by the full Senate could come as early as Thursday. Bush said the controversy over Tower goes against America's sense of fair play. Claiming no one has challenged Tower's ability for the job, Bush complained his nominee has been pilloried by unfounded rumor.
Well, on the basis of unfounded rumor. And so if somebody has a specific objection, fine. They have every right in the world to state it. But I don't think it is fair to permit perception to be the guideline. And therefore, I will continue to fight for this man that I believe in.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said there's no chance whatsoever the nomination will be withdrawn, noting that Tower, too, intends to fight to the full. I'm Ann Garrels at the White House.
The criminal trial of Oliver North remained on hold today as the result of new arguments about the release of government secrets. North's lawyer, Brendan Sullivan, asked that all 12 criminal charges in the case be thrown out, claiming prosecutors were guilty of a fraud on the defense. Today's dispute centered on documents introduced in court as classified but made available in uncensored versions to a private activist group. Testimony in the trial has been suspended for the past 2 days. A 150-member aviation industry task force today recommended mandatory changes rather than inspections be made on about 1,300 older Boeing aircraft. Carol Levinson reports.
The task force is studying other kinds of planes besides Boeing models, but those recommendations aren't ready yet. What the task force is recommending to the Federal Aviation Administration so far concerns Boeing 727s, 37s, and 47s. Specifically, the industry group says instead of inspecting certain parts of a plane for cracking and other problems once it reaches a certain age, mandatory repairs or modifications should be made. The group estimates its proposals would cost the airlines about $600,000 per plane, but the task force says many airlines already have such programs underway. The task force says if such preventive work is done, a plane can fly indefinitely. The group disagrees with some members of Congress that feel a mandatory retirement age should be set for commercial planes. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson.
An airline investigation said today that a cargo door that ripped off a Boeing 747 over the Pacific Friday had electrical problems in recent months. In addition, a seal on the door was repaired in January. The United Airlines jet lost 9 passengers after the door broke off, and pilots were able to turn the plane around and land it, even though 2 engines had died. Immigration officials in Los Angeles seized another 69 illegal aliens about to board an Eastern Airlines flight to Atlanta. The arrests come a day after immigration officials in Atlanta arrested 79 undocumented immigrants on the same overnight Eastern flight. Of those apprehended today, 54 were from Mexico, 7 from El Salvador, 4 from Colombia, and 4 from Guatemala. Most will be allowed to go home or request a deportation hearing. Authorities say some of the illegals indicated they'd paid up to $4,000 for illegal papers. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There's a lot of talk these days about Louisiana-style cooking, but rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a survey of some classic Louisiana music, a blend of Cajun, soul, rhythm and blues, and country.
certainly helped give birth to rock and roll, and as soon as it began to sizzle, record companies swooped in. But there was fertile ground elsewhere in Louisiana, a hotbed of fine pop music that lay undiscovered until the early 60s. In the area lying between Lake Charles and Lafayette, Cajun rock and rollers, Black and White, were making music that went unremarked at the time, but is considered classic today.
Your love for me will always be.
In the Cupcakes, Matilda was the key record. The bass line and chord progression would turn up in hundreds of records from this area in the next 5 years. But when it was released in 1959, it was only a regional hit. That's how things started in those days. From Louisiana or East Texas, it looked like a monster. And that was the sort of thing that would inspire a guy cutting hair somewhere to throw down his scissors and find somebody to record.
Breaking up is hard to do.
Jive and Gene Bourgeois's Breaking Up Is Hard to Do was produced by a barber from Winnie in Texas's rice-growing country named Huey P. Moe, the Crazy Cajun, as he liked to style himself. It became a sizable enough hit to get picked up by Mercury Records in New York, and Moe called on another Cajun friend, Floyd Swallow, in Ville Platte, Louisiana, to scout out talent for the two of them to record. It turned out there was talent everywhere. You had crooners like Rod Bernard.
This should go on forever.
Hear those Matilda licks? There were soul singers like Clint West, who sang with the Boogie Kings, a show band in the great teen dance tradition.
Big diamond, big blue diamond on the finger, oh yeah, instead of a little band of gold.
And Huey Moe discovered the tragic Jimmy Donnelly, who sang like a white Fats Domino, and, Huey maintains, sold a number of hits to the fat man to claim as his own.
There's a pain inside my heart, dear, and a burning deep within. If I can't be a lover, won't you let me be a friend? I guess I took too much for granted.
Depressed by his mother's death, Donnelly committed suicide in his car, his guitar and a white Bible near him, along with a picture of his wife and his mother's obituary clipped from the local paper. Only two South Louisiana artists ever had major pop success, though. Dale and Grace were brother and sister and harmonized like it, which got them into the top 10 in 1963.
I'm leaving it all up to you.
Matilda strikes again. And in 1966, well after these performers had gone off to obscurity, along came Tommy McLean with his amazing reading of Don Gibson's country classic, Sweet Dreams. Compilation albums of this stuff are still available on Floyd Swallow's Gin label, and you'll find everybody from Willie Nelson to Elvis Costello waxing enthusiastic about it these days. No wonder. There was a lot of soul in those swamps.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Michael Tucker was a few inches too short for many of the leading man roles he would have liked to play, but now he has a leading role each week as Stuart Markowitz on the TV series L.A. Law. He plays opposite the taller Jill Eikenberry, who is his wife on and off the show. Besides performing in the theater, Tucker has appeared in the films Diner and Radio Days. On a break last season from L.A. Law, Tucker shot the upcoming CBS TV movie Day One. He stars as Leo Szilard, a Hungarian-Jewish physicist who helped develop the atomic bomb and early on saw the implications of its use.
Of course they can give a warning if they want. Of course they can have a demonstration. What? They can drop it in the woods near a city. They can warn the Japanese to clear out the city and then drop it. What, they can blow up Mount Fuji if they want. Yeah, but that is not what they want. They want to drop the bomb. We are the men who conceived this bomb. And before God and the world, we have the duty to see that it is used wisely. We will be held responsible.
Tucker says he wanted to play Leo Szilard more than any other role in his career. That's why he really went after the part.
I found that they weren't going to offer me the role after I had read it, and I was furious about it. I said, I have to play this part. And they said that they wanted a European to play it because of the accent. He's Hungarian. I said, well, you call him and tell him I can do that accent. And I went in and I auditioned for them. And fortunately got the part.
How did you know a Hungarian accent?
I played a character in a play called The Kitchen by Arnold Wesker. I played a Hungarian character. This I'm going back about 20 years, when I was at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. And when I went in to read for Day One, I actually did a speech from the kitchen. I said, I'm not really up on this script yet, but let me show you the accent. And I did the speech from that, and it worked.
It's funny, for years you were an actor who wasn't a household name, but in the past couple of years, everybody's gotten to know your name, and now you have to start worrying about people confusing you with the character that you play on L.A. Law.
Yeah, I think doing Day One will help that, and doing other work. This character is as very far from Stuart Markowitz, really different. You know, I've always been a character actor. I play different kinds of things.
Well, you know, there was a New York Times headline back in 1987 in an article about you, and the headline was, "Once a Nebbish, Now a Sex Symbol."
You want me to comment on that?
Well, I
was never a nebbish.
Yeah, well, honestly. Yeah. But I was wondering how you reacted to this kind of surprise that you could play somebody really sexual. Do you know what I mean? Who would be sexually attractive.
Yeah, it has something to do with stereotypes. and the media. You know, I don't know why it's a surprise that somebody who looks like me can be a sex symbol. Shouldn't be a big problem. I understand why. I understand the way the stereotypes work. But it doesn't work that way in life. So I think the relationship between Jill and I on this show is more realistic than most relationships on television or in film.
And people always assume that TV actors, actors who are on TV every week, are just like the roles that they play. Hmm. And I wonder if that's even more true, if the assumption is made more often in a situation like yours when you play a married man and in mm-hmm. real life you're actually married to the person
yeah.
who you play opposite.
Yeah, and in many ways it's true. We don't have, I don't know, there are things about our relationship in real life that certainly spill out onto the screen, but we don't have as good writers in our life as we do in LA Law. I wish we did. But so our arguments are not nearly as witty.
Do you want to have a baby or not?
I don't know.
What? You were the one who was talking about exploring all the options. Now all of a sudden you don't know?
I'm 38 years old. I love my work. I'm not sure I'm ready to put it on the back burner indefinitely.
Why would you have to put it on the back burner?
Oh, please. You're not the one that's going to stay home when the kid has an ear infection. At least be honest about that.
How can you take something so simple, the most natural thing in the world, and roll it up into this complicated mess?
Terms.
I want
to
have a baby, Anne. What about you?
I'll be damned if I'm going to let you railroad me into caving in on something so important,
fine.
Stuart. It takes two. You keep forgetting that, Stuart. You could have world-class Olympic sperm. It still takes two.
Well, that's great, Anne. Why don't you say it a little louder? Some of the partners still have their doors closed.
L.A. Law made you and Jill Eikenberry famous at the same time.
Mm.
I think when there's a two-actor couple, that there's a lot of ups and downs in the relationships. Both partners aren't always working at
right.
the same time.
We went through that.
Is there a problem of jealousy in relationships like that?
Yeah.
Where you envy the person who's working and feel depressed when you're not?
Absolutely. We've done that a lot. In the beginning, when we first came to New York, Jill's career sort of shot off and mine stood still for a year or two. It was a very, very difficult time for our relationship. Then there was a switch in things where my career sort of spurted forward and Jill's went on the wane a little bit. And that flip-flop happened about six times over a period of almost 20 years that we've been together. And the flip-flop back and forth helped us realize that that it doesn't really mean anything, and that my career is my career, and it doesn't matter what's happening to hers. It's a hard lesson to learn, and we went through a lot of trouble over that. We're incredibly lucky that we became household words at the same time.
Can you tell the story of how you were cast in L.A. Law?
Yes, I will. Listen, my children, and you shall hear. Stephen Bochco, who's the creator of L.A. Law as well as Hill Street Blues, is an old friend of mine. We went to college together, and we've remained friends over the years. And he's tried to seduce us out to California before. But he called us, and he said, look, I'm writing this new show about lawyers, and if it's okay with you, I'd like to pattern these two characters after you and Jill. Now, you don't have to play them, but is it okay with you if I think of you when I'm writing them? We said, sure. Well, 6 months later, the script came, and it was wonderful. And there was no turning it down. So we sort of uprooted ourselves and went out and did the show.
When he said pattern the characters after you, did he mean pattern them after your personalities or just think of you as being the actress for the role?
I think the latter, because they weren't really patterned after our personalities. Jill is not nearly as aggressive and strident as Ann Kelsey. I'm not nearly as shy as Stuart Markowitz. There are big differences. But Bochco's a real smart guy. He knew, say in Jill's case, he knew that if a very aggressive, direct and strident person were playing Ann Kelsey, then you'd lose all the other aspects of that character. It would become two-dimensional. So casting Jill, who's a much softer person, more rounded person, gave much more dimension to Kelsey.
A few months ago, in our offices, we were rescreening The Eyes of Laura Mars.
I have a great story about that.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. This was in a very lean period for me, and Jill was doing quite well. She had a couple of films in a row and was becoming very well known in the business. We walked into a restaurant, Patsy's up in the theater district, great old Italian restaurant. And there is a famous casting person, Sis Corman, as a matter of fact, and she makes a big fuss over Jill. And I'm standing there, and she looks at me, and she says, "Oh, you're an actor too, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm an actor too." And she said, "Call me in the morning. I might have something for you." And I said, "Well, great." And I called her, and I went in, and she said, "Well, the director's in a meeting, and we'll wait for him." And we waited for a couple of hours, and finally she said, "Oh, never mind. I'm just giving you the part. It's one day. You're working one day on this picture." And there wasn't even a name for my character. I was playing Faye Dunaway's art director. So I go to a party the night before the shooting, a big party for the movie, and my friend Rene Aubergin was there, and he has a big part in the movie. And we talk, and we're happy that we're working together. And the next day, Rene and I and Faye Dunaway sort of improvise a lot, and Rene gives me a name. He calls me Bert, and Bert is doing this, and we're running around, and suddenly I'm improvising a lot of lines. And at the end of the day, which should be the end of the movie for me, Rene goes over to the director, Erwin Kirshner, and he says, "I don't see how you can possibly not have Bert in the birthday party scene." And Kirshner says, "Who the hell is Bert?" You know, nobody knew, the character didn't have a name. But Rene convinced him that I had to be in this scene, and then I had to be in this scene, and I got 8 weeks of work out of it, which was really amazing at that time. Well, I owed it all to Rene.
I just want to tell you that when we saw you in the movie, it was like, slap your face. That's Michael Tucker, because it didn't look like you. I'm trying to remember that you had a beard
hair.
And really long
yeah,
hair.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel that way seeing yourself? Like, oh,
yeah,
my gosh, that's me. I don't recognize
very
me.
Very bizarre. Very bizarre to see me, especially in those days, those old hippie days. Yeah, I was a hairy son of a gun.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay.
This Sunday, Michael Tucker stars in the CBS TV movie Day One. He plays Stuart Markowitz on the NBC TV series L.A. Law. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry.
What are you following?
Lots of stories tonight, including this one from Yugoslavia. Maybe a million people demonstrating on the streets of Belgrade, demonstrating over issues of tension in the Kosovo province, tension between Serbians and Albanians who live there. The nation's airline industry has presented a plan to the Federal Aviation Agency calling for a repair program for older aircraft. It could involve 1,000 planes. And it's conceivable it would have involved a change in the cargo door of the Boeing 747 that lost that door after leaving Honolulu last week. Also, Konrad Lorenz has died, the Austrian scientist, a world-renowned ethologist known for his studies in animal behavior.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Margaret Atwood is one of Canada's most prominent writers and one of the leading feminist authors of our day. Her body of work includes more than 20 books of poetry, fiction, and essays. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Atwood's new novel, Cat's Eye.
Margaret Atwood can be lyrical, as in surfacing, and she can be funny, as in Lady Oracle. A Handmaid's Tale, her dystopian novel, took the long view in a gloomy one. Bodily Harm, in which a journalist left Toronto to report on death styles in the Caribbean, to meet grandmothers with machine guns, and to dream of severed hands, is said to have been autobiographical and was certainly unpleasant. Atwood's latest, Cat's Eye, is also said to be autobiographical. This is how she feels today about fame and feminism, and it most resembles Bodily Harm. Instead of the journalist Rene, we're inside the head of an artist, Elaine. Instead of being married, like Rene, to the feckless Jake, a designer of advertising package deals, Elaine has been married to John, who designs sets for Hollywood splatter flicks about chainsaw massacres. Instead of being, like Rene, afraid of men, quote, because, it's simple, men are frightening, Elaine has decided that men are merely mindless, like the weather, or, quote, slippery rocks with jagged edges. Fallen women were women who had fallen onto men and hurt themselves. And instead of finding in female friendship something redemptive, as Rene did, Elaine looks back from her 80s eminence to her 50s adolescence and sees her childhood female friends as traitors and sadists. Once upon a time, quite literally, they buried her alive. After a long absence and a second marriage, Elaine returns to Toronto for a retrospective of her work. She looks at her past, the land of the dead people, through the blue eye marooned in a favorite childhood marble, which Cat's Eye also appears in her paintings. Her art is a vengeance on those who betrayed and tormented her, who were lost to death or madness, and especially on Cordelia, with whom, in the novel's most powerful conceit, she seems to have exchanged identities, to have saved herself by becoming a bully. Elaine and Cordelia used to read horror comics. In one of them, a pretty girl goes to dances and has a boyfriend. Her ugly, envious sister, with a burned face, hangs herself in front of a mirror. The pretty one, looking into this mirror, sees the burned face, faints, and is invaded by the ugly one. Later on, Elaine reflects, "I'm not afraid of seeing Cordelia. I'm afraid of being Cordelia, because in some way we changed places, and I've forgotten when." Cat's Eye is, of course, more complicated than this. Each of its 15-chapter books is itself a painting, remote like a Japanese landscape, hanging from wicked epigrams. Each sharp-edged image inflicts a wound. It's as if, by the very act of choosing to become an artist, Elaine had turned glacial, pitiless, inhuman, a disembodied, savage eye. I'm not sure the old light from dying stars into which she rises at the end is really enough to see by, nor am I sure she's escaped Cordelia. For all its fierce intelligence, its abrasive wit, its knowingness, Cat's Eye is a novel of nightmare unhappiness.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Cat's Eye by Margaret Atwood. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, a talk with actress Pamela Reed. She played Belle Starr in the film The Long Riders and the campaign manager in Tanner 88. Now she stars in a new movie about life in a small town in the Midwest. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of composer Harold Shapiro's Symphony for Classical Orchestra. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses the use of the word nigger in American popular culture, in such places as Kernan Hammerstein's Showboat and Eugene O'Neill's Emperor Jones. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.